everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Talk of Gasoline Alley. Coming to you live from the garage area of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And our thanks to the Dry and Reinbold Racing Team for allowing us to be in their garage throughout the month. We're here Monday through Friday up through the race. And we invite you to give us a call. The lines are already loaded up, but we'll give you the number anyway. It is 1-800-603-6453. 1-800-603-6453. And let's go straight to Bill from St. Louis. Good evening.
Hi, Donald. Comment and a couple questions, I guess. The other day you were talking about Phil Krueger.
Yes.
And there was something on one of the Legends of the Brickyard that years ago, and he said that after he won, or after he competed in the 88 race, that instead of having a big elaborate party or whatever, like a lot of the high-priced teams were, he went home and mowed the lawn.
Oh, well, I don't remember that, but I'm not surprised at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other thing was that somebody had talked about the zero numbers.
Yes.
And there was a guy, 96, I think it was, his name was Joe Gosick, and they called him Double O.
Double O, yeah, yeah.
Did he do a zero, or did they not allow him to do a zero that year?
No, I think that was the number that he had on his Super Modified, I believe. But no, he didn't run that here. In fact, I don't recall what he did use, but it wasn't that.
And the last one was, what was the last year that Jim Herdebees ran a Roadster at the 500? How did he do, and did he have a rear-engine career at the Speedway, and how did he do?
Okay, well, the answer to the second part is yes. the first time he drove a rear-engine car was 66. So his front engine, or his rear engine starts rather were 66, 72, and 74. The last time that he had the front engine car that he built himself, the only time they had that in the race was 1968. He was on the track with it as late as 1979. He was entered in 80. Or he may have been on the track in 80. He may have practiced in 80, but that would have absolutely been the last time, but he was no longer serious about it.
Oh, that's amazing. So when was the 68 he had the Roadster in the race?
Yeah, it was a front engine car. The Pepsi Frito-Lay special. But he only lasted 9 laps.
Oh, okay.
So when that was rolled through the garage area or rolled through the pit gate, that was the last time that a front engine car would be seen in the race.
Thank you.
All right then. We thank you for the call. And let's go to Tom from up in Huntington. Good evening, Tom.
Hi, Donald. Just calling in. I used to go to the track all the time back in the 70s and the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And there's a driver, his name is Jerry Grant.
Yes.
And he was one of my favorites back then, and
okay.
I just never heard no more about him. If you could give me some profile on him, I'd really appreciate it.
All right, absolutely. Well, I haven't seen him this year. He worked for Champion Sparkler Company for a number of years, but they got sold a couple of times and completely out of racing. So as far as a driver was concerned, he had quite a lengthy tenure. 64 was the first year that he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd passed the rookie test, made a qualifying attempt, but he didn't make it into the race. So 65 was his first start.
Mm-hmm.
And he drove the Bardol MG Liquid Suspension Special and was fairly early out, finished 27th. He was 10th in 66. In 67, he qualified and got bumped in a car called the Freakin' Eagle, owned by Tommy Freakin. And then he was invited to join Dan Gurney's team again. He was a long-time Gurney occasional teammate, but confidant, and they ran around together quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so he then qualified as a teammate to Dan and to Jochen Rindt, and he was 20th in that one. And then in 68, he drove a Bardol-sponsored car that was black and white checkers, and he was 23rd in that. Then 69, he didn't make it. He was drove for Rollo Volstead, made an incomplete attempt, and ended up not making it. Then 1970, he had his own entry. It was the Nelson Ironworks Special, and it was the very, very last entry to come in. I remember that because there's nothing really to do with the story, but I happened to be up at the post office. I'm still working for USAC at the time, and I'll go up to the Speedway post office to pick up some mail, and they said, oh, are you going to be going by the track? And I said, well, I could. And they said, well, this entry just came in, and it was sort of like, it was probably about April the 20th or something, but it was postmarked by the 15th. So I took it. I had the privilege, if that would be the term, of actually taking it over to the track. And they said, oh, yeah, we knew that one was coming. But so I actually delivered it. So there used to be a rush about delivering the first entry to the track. Well, that was the only time I've delivered an entry, and I managed to deliver the last entry. Anyway, he finished seventh. Thanks to me, because if, you know, if I could have kept that. I never thought about that. I could have really messed him up, didn't I? Really? Anyway, in 71, he drove a car that was sponsored by Norris Industries, and he qualified and got bumped. And then in 72, he drove a car called the Mystery Eagle, and this was actually his best shot. And, it was a teammate to Dan Gurney's. It was sponsored by a fellow named Chris Ballow, who was a Greek from northern Indiana, who was surrounded in mystery, and had an empire that collapsed shortly after that. But anyway, Jerry Grant was running second, actually led the race late stages. He came in to make a pit stop, and when he did that, the fuel hose was hooked up from the Bobby Unser pit, and they sent him back out, and he actually crossed the line second behind Mark Donahue. Well, a discussion took place after the race, and they didn't announce the official results were not posted until 8 o'clock the following morning, and it was determined that since he had used up all of his fuel allotment and there was no fuel left in the tank in his pit, that by going to the Bobby Unser pit, his teammate, that was a violation of the rules. And rather than disqualify him, they did what I think was a very fair thing. They disallowed all of the laps since the final pit stop. So the last 12 laps were not allowed, and he showed us 188 laps in 12th place. And so anyway, they argued that they may have hooked the refueling mechanism up, but they hadn't turned any fuel in. Well, how could you ever know that? So, I think that was probably the fair thing to do. Anyway, he claims to this day that he should have won the race. Well, he should. He could very easily have finished second. He should have finished second.
Three, wasn't it?
I'm sorry?
His last race was 73.
Oh, no, he went beyond that. Great. Now we're going to fire up an engine. Just to let you know, we are in the garage area at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. In 73, and I won't be able to hear you for a little bit, in 1973, he drove one of three Olsenite Eagles in the race, Bobby Unser and Wally Dallenbach being the others. He didn't finish that one. In 74, he drove for Robert Fletcher, Bob Fletcher, with a Cobra Firestone special, and he finished 10th. And then in 75, he was in a car that was called the Spirit of Orange County, which was a really neat paint job, and he was 20th in that one. And then then the final start came in 76 when he drove for a car called the California-Oklahoma Special, and the race was stopped at halfway because of rain, and he was flagged off 26th. And then in 77, he was in a couple of different cars for the Hoffmans, and he had an incomplete attempt at hitting the wall. He did have a landmark in history. They went to Ontario in 1972, and he was Bobby Unser's teammate. And Bobby Unser had a problem on the first of two qualifying days, and Jerry Grant went out and won the pole, and he was the first person to qualify at an average speed of 200 miles an hour or better. Although Tom Sneba did that here in 1977, or actually had qualifying laps of 200 in 1977, Jerry Grant was able to do that at Ontario in 1972. So anyway, I didn't count up the number of the starts, but I think it was 10. So he had quite a lengthy career, and then After that, then he got involved with the Champion Highway Safety Program, and when that ended, then he continued on as a public relations man for Champion Spark Plug. All right. Anyway, Scott Johnson went outside and just wrote me a note that we are listening to the number 77 Stefan Gregoire car. That's the engine that's running. But now, A, they shut the door, and B, they turned the engine off, so now we can't hear it anymore. But anyway, will that do it for you, with Jerry Grant?
He was such a man as far as his quotes. You know, he was funny. You know,
he was, yes.
And he'd say, when the 73 race, I remember he just took his cloth off his head, you know, mm-hmm. his fire thing, just, it's making an old man out of me.
Yeah, well, you know, he was, he had a receding hairline, which he liked to not have you know, and so that's why he always walked around with a headsock. And it was a time also when every time you saw him, he was drinking, he had a soft drink out of a can. But he was a big man. He did drive stock cars a little bit. I mean, he was in the Daytona 500 and back when everybody was a lot more diversified than they are now, and he was a good sports car driver. Anyway, we ran over a little bit. We want to thank you very much indeed. I think you're a first-time caller, so call us back again. Paul from Racine, Dave from Marion, hang on. We will be back with more on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We want to thank everybody for hanging on. Paul and Racine, you've been through this before. You're up. Good evening.
Hi, Donald.
Thanks for hanging again.
Hey, Donald, if I could, real quick, I just want to follow up on a Jerry Grant story.
Yes, please.
A couple of years ago, I was at the ticket office getting my grad credential, and I saw him there, and I talked to him, and I was surprised at how tall he is. I'm 6'1", and he's taller than me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're so used to race car drivers being short. But I just remember, you know, mentioning to him, hey, you know, hi, you're Jerry Grant, so on and so forth. And then I asked him about the 72 race, and he did say, he just was real matter-of-fact about it. He's just like, that's where I go, it's for whatever. And it just struck me as funny, you know, because here, you know, the guy was so close to winning it, and he just kind of seemed to take it all in stride. So,
yeah.
Donald, can you talk a little bit about John Zink?
John Drake?
No,
John Zink. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. A comment on Jerry Grant. He used to be a large man. He's thin for the last 20 years perhaps. But when he was racing, certainly at the very beginning, I mean, he was a pretty hefty fellow. And so not only tall, but just a big man. And he lost quite a bit of weight quite a few years ago, so now he's a beanpole. All right, John Zink, Tulsa, Oklahoma. In 1950 and 51, there was a John Zink special that was actually sponsored by the company, and it was the father as much as the son. John Jr. Was 23 years old in 1952, and that's when he entered his first car, and it was driven by Jimmy Reese, who finished seventh. And then in 1953, he had Jerry Hoyt, who did not finished 23rd. We haven't been doing the finishing position so much anymore because I don't know that they really mean as much as maybe the distance or whatever. But anyway, that was the year of the heat. Chuck Stevenson and Andy Linden also co-drove the car, but 23rd was the finishing position, as it was the next year when the driver was Gene Hartley, who took relief from Marshall Teague. Anyway, that was the same car. That was a dirt car all the way through. In 55, he bought a new Curtis and hired Bob Swikert for the driver, A.J. Watson for the mechanic, and they ended up in Victory Lane. That was the first of two victories for John Zink. The following year, they had A.J. Watson then built a new car, which was the first of the so-called Watson Roadsters, and Pat Flaherty drove that. It was supposed to be, it was being built for Swikert, but then Swikert had a disagreement with John Zink over something that appeared in the contract, and so they parted ways. Pat Flaherty, a longtime friend of Watson's, was hired to drive the new car, and then Troy Ruttman drove the 55 Swikert winner. Now, he was not the original choice, but they didn't know that Ruttman was going to be available. But the first person that John Cink offered that car to was Stirling Moss of Great Britain. So,
what was the connection then?
Most people only looked within the, you know, just looked within their immediate area. John Cink liked road racing. He liked sports car racing, and he read the magazines, and he knew about Fangio and Stirling Moss, and so he offered the car to Moss, and Moss declined it politely, saying that he would be interested in doing Indianapolis someday, but he would only do it in a British car. So Ruttman got the ride. Ruttman was an early out. Flaherty won the race, so Zink was the winner 2 years in a row. And then during the winter, Watson built another new car. This one was for Troy Ruttman, and he started on the outside of the front row and was out very early. They only went 13 laps, burned a piston. I know why. Won't go into that now. In 58, there were three John Cink specials because Watson built another new one, plus the 56 winner they had, which had been there in 57 with Jed Larson, got bumped. And so in 58, it was Jimmy Reese on the outside of the front row. The infamous Ed Elysian was in the middle of the front row. And then Jed Larson qualified for his first of only two 500s in the back. And then on the pole was a car that A.J. Watson had built during the winter and entered the car with the view strictly to selling it. John Cink wasn't very happy about that. He felt that since Watson was in his employ, that he shouldn't be building cars for other people. And it got the case got worse when Lee Elkins purchased the car 6 days before the first qualifying day. It became the McNamara Special. Dick Rathman became the driver, and he won the pole, knocking Elysian off the pole and moving Jimmy Reese over to the outside front row. So anyway, Watson or Zink rather wanted Watson to move to Tulsa, Oklahoma, which he didn't want to do. And obviously, I'm going to have to make this a two-parter because there's a lot more to talk about John Cink. So we'll listen to the music. Dave, you hang on. Mark, you hang on. 1-800-603-6453 is the number to call. 1-800-603-6453. We're going to take a break here and talk more about John Cink after the break on the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. Welcome to the second half of the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We'll be here until 8 o'clock and then be back through the rest of the week through Friday and then next week, Monday through Friday. We're talking with Paul from Racine, Wisconsin, and he was asking about John Cink, and we got up to 1958. John Cink was not very happy at all about the fact that Watson had built that additional car and then sold it to somebody else, and he said, but you're working for me. But Watson said, yeah, but I did that in my spare time. So anyway, then John Cink suggested moving the race shop to Tulsa, Oklahoma, so he could keep an eye on Watson, and Watson didn't want to leave Indianapolis. So it also coincided with the time that Bob Wilkie, Liederkurz, longtime car sponsor, now was thinking of becoming an owner, and in wanting to get the best he could, he contacted A.J. Watson about building a car and being chief mechanic, and the timing was perfect. And Watson was living in Indianapolis, Wilkie was living in Milwaukee, and they agreed that they'd split the difference and meet in Chicago. So they had the meeting, and out of it came, you know about that, don't you? So they, out of it, they made an arrangement, and I think Watson continued with Zink up through the Ducoin 100, I think, by which time they had Tony Bettenhausen. And then he left, and then Denny Moore became the chief mechanic for Zink, and Watson then went to Liederkurz. So in 59, the Zink team was Pat Flaherty making a comeback because he'd been injured in at Springfield in 1956, chasing the national championship, and had a serious arm injury, and it took him a couple of years to get back. Yes, he made the comeback in August of 58, so he's now, for the first time in 3 years, he was back at Indianapolis with one car, and they had Bob Veith in the other. And Flaherty actually led the race for a while and was running fourth at 164 laps when he spun off turn four and hit the inside wall, just north of the pits, not that hard, but, you know, enough. And there are those that think that he just got tired. He was never the strongest guy to begin with. Very thin and very pale skinned and very, very determined. But there are those that thought that since it's the first time he'd run a long race since his injury, that he probably should have come in and taken a relief driver. Well, anyway, Vaith soldiered along to finish 12th. And then in 1960, they had Troy Ruttman. In 61, they had Troy Ruttman. Did not finish either time. And in 61, there was Ruttman drove a Watson Roadster. Well, actually, it was a Denny Moore-built Roadster that was a Watson copy. But he had actually entered a rear-engine car called the John Saint Track Burner, which was supposed to be a turbine. And the chassis they built themselves. The chassis arrived. The engine didn't. The chassis was not on the track during May, although the car was in the garage area. And Ruttman had his photograph taken with it, but it's the Roadster that he drove. And then during the summer, they put an Offenhauser in it, and Bill Cheeseburg drove it in a tire test. But then but it didn't handle very well, and so they decided, well, we made a mistake. Let's build a new car. So they built another rear-engine car that was very strongly influenced by the Lotus and the Cooper of the day. They put a Boeing gas turbine in it, and they hired Dan Gurney for the driver. And Gurney came to the track, took his test in a Roadster, which is a little trivia because a lot of people didn't realize that Gurney did actually drive around the speedway in a front-engine car. But I'm sorry?
Are there any pictures of that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Just love to get a picture of that.
Go to the photo shop upstairs.
Okay.
On the second floor. And but anyway, he drove the turbine for several days. They couldn't get it going. And then Gurney then departed and then ended up qualifying for Mickey Thompson. Chuck Hulse and Dwayne Carter amongst those who shipped down the turbine and it never went to the qualifying line. But it just goes to show that Zinc was always looking for something a little bit different. It was status quo in 63 because the Denny Moore car, they hired Lloyd Ruby, who in 61 had driven for Zinc and the Milwaukee 200 and won it. And he was running second in the 500 in 63. And crashed at 128 laps, I think it was. Anyway, he finished 19th. Then in 64, never status quo, or at least not very often status quo. During the summer of 63, he contacted Jack Brabham, who had won the two of his three world champions at that time. And they built a car, the John Zink Track Burner, but it was built by Brabham. And Brabham was the driver, but for Indianapolis only. With the arrangement being that as soon as Indianapolis was over, Brabham would leave, and then it was Zink's car, and he'd do with it as he wished. Brabham did not finish the 64 500, but Jimmy McAreath had quite a bit of fortune with the car. During the summer, Clint Brauner went down and measured it, actually borrowed the car, measured it, and then built his own, which he called the Brauner Hawk. And then he built another copy for Denny Moore. Or at least I think he gave Denny Moore the measurements is what happened, and Denny Moore built his own. But the Brauner Hawk the series of Brauner Hawks that carried Mario to so much success in 65, 66, 67, those were actually, there was a dead copy of a Brabham. Anyway, in the meantime, Zink had McAreath in 65, we're almost done here, 65, McAreath did not finish. In 66, he was third. And pardon me, we both got attacked at the same time by something. Here we are all this distance apart, and I was gulping for a moment there. Anyway, he was third in 66 and fifth in 67, and then I think he ran just a couple more races that summer, but 67 was the last time that John Zink was a car owner. So that's kind of a lengthy dissertation on his Indianapolis career. He actually raced himself. He won a stock car class at the U.S. National Drags in 57, I think.
Holy cow! I would have never guessed that.
I think I'm almost sure 57 was the year. Then he did a lot of off-road racing. He had vehicles that Denny Moore built. And they called them Zors, Z-O-R-R, which stood for Zink Off-Road Racing. And John Sink drove those quite a bit. And you know, he was for a long time a teenager at heart. They were industrialists. The John Sink Heater Company built industrial, can't think of the term now, for the environment, where they put these, they build these things like filters to put on top of smokestacks so that it would keep all the impurities in. And he ran for office at one time. There was an Oklahoma office that he was after, but he didn't win that. But he still was very much the politician and would come back every year and bring a lot of Oklahoma dignitaries with him, including the governor of Oklahoma, who came back with him one time. And he is now deceased. A book was written that was started while he was still alive about his life. I haven't seen it. I believe it's published by now. And so, Paul, I think that'll probably about do it for now.
That's very impressive. As impressive as the museum, the cards that the museum has, Donald. I always enjoy the show, and the knowledge is just awesome. In fact, the one I really enjoy.
Okay, quickie, just real quick here. He went to the Monza 500 both years with the same car, and Troy Ruttman was overall second in 57, and then with Jim Rathman was the overall winner in 58, and that car is in the museum. So thank you, Paul. Maybe we'll hear from you from tomorrow night. We thank you for calling. Dave, hang on. We've got to take a break here, and we'll be back right after this. Talk of Gasoline Alley, Network, Indiana. We're back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network, Indiana. We thank you for joining us, and we thank the Brian Reinbold Racing Team for allowing us to use their garage for the month of May to bring you this program. And we go to a faithful listener, Dave from Marion. Good evening, Dave.
Hi, Donald.
How are you?
Real good, thanks.
Good.
Thanks as usual.
Good. Well, a little bird reminded us yesterday that today is your birthday, so happy birthday, Dave.
Actually, it's tomorrow.
Oh!
Jerry called, and so I said, thank you very much.
Okay, the little bird's name was Jerry, so he was off a day.
I thought it might have been. He's real good to remember that.
Okay.
Frankie Delroy was in the USAC plane crash, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And you and he were together a lot at USAC before that.
We were indeed, yes.
And he did many things in the 500, of course. Mm-hmm. But would you do some Frankie Delroy?
Absolutely. He was, thank you. He was a really special guy, a wonderful source. Because he'd done so much, and he was great with stories. And I would hardly know where to begin, except that he was a riding mechanic in the 500 several times. And let's see, he rode with Floyd Roberts. He rode with Bill Cummings. In fact, he was the last riding mechanic to be on the pole. But I'm hazy on a couple of others. I think he rode with Louis Tomei in 35. But anyway, Bill Cummings in 37 on the pole. And the car actually jumped out of gear, and according to the newspaper report, it looked like Bill Cummings was running doing the pole run alone. Again, it was bricks except for the turns were now asphalt, but it was still a rough ride for most of the way around, and the car jumped out of gear. 10-lap qualifying in those days, not four. And so Frankie got down into what they call the basement to hold the thing in gear, and so it looked like that Bill Cummings was riding it alone. But I remember that he said that he was from New Jersey. His father wanted him to be a musician, so he was learning to play the violin, but he, on his way to where he was supposed to take the music lessons, there was a garage that had race cars, so he used to hang around in there, and then it ended up in that you'd be late for the music lesson, then he stopped going to the music lesson, and then he said that finally his father ran into the music teacher and said, how is my son doing? And he said, well, I haven't seen him for several weeks. So he confronted me when I got home, and he was very mad. And I said, what did he do? He said, he hit me over the head with the violin. Mm-hmm. But anyway, let's see. He after the riding mechanic days were over, he was a mechanic on several cars. He was with the Marx team. That's M-A-R-K-S. Which, Joe Marx, whose mother-in-law was Mary Falcone, that they called Grandma Marx, and she ran the show. Anyway, that was Duke Nalen and then Tommy Hennischitz, the great East Coast dirt track driver. Then in 41, he was on Lou Moore's team with the Floyd Davis Maury Rose car that they shared the victory. A fellow named Ed Champey was listed as the chief mechanic on that, but Frankie Delroy was on the crew, and occasionally the claim is that he was the winning chief mechanic. Then you come back after the war, the Ross Page special with Mel Hansen. Frankie was the mechanic on that. In 51, in fact, he helped, actually, he helped me, with information that he gave me, dispelled at least one great myth. And rather than run us up against the wall, which I've done a couple of times, we'll take a break here, Dave, if you don't mind hanging on, because there's quite a bit more Frankie Delroy to do. Mark, you hang on, and we'll just take care of some business here. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana. We are back with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana, and we'll hurry along here and try to get through Frankie Delroy. In 1951... Jim Robbins had purchased the car that had carried Johnny Parsons to victory in 1950, right after the race. In fact, he made the deal the night before the race, and he would take delivery of it after the race. And Frankie was hired as the chief mechanic, and in 1951 he was able to introduce the Mike Nazarek to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Now, he was fairly responsible for bringing Bill Schindler back in 1950, another great East Coast dirt track driver, bought Nazarek in 51, and they finished second. And the real story there is that there's this myth that had been going around for years that Johnny Parsons won the 1950 500 with a cracked block, and that the race was stopped at 345 miles because of rain, and that he was saved by the rain because there's no way that the thing could go the distance. Well, mechanics told me that what happened was there was not a crack in the block, that they noticed that there was moisture on the head. They wiped it off, come back a few minutes later, more moisture, and so they got rags, put it around the side of the head and began to peen it with a hammer, and what they did was able to seal what was, it was porosity in the metal. That was one part of the cracked block myth. The other one was that, and then back up to the thought. The thinking was that, well, Parsons is going to go out, lead as many laps as he can before the thing breaks down. Well, Jim Robbins takes delivery of the car, and Frankie said he could never get him to change the block. And so Nazarek actually ran with the same block in the car the next year. And they'd run it at Darlington in 1950, in December 50, with Joey Chitwood, who drove his last race ever with Frankie as the mechanic. So anyway, Nazarek gets second with the crack block. And then the following year, Frankie brought back to the Speedway with him Art Cross, who qualified for Ray Brady and finished fifth. So he brought these two great rookies back in consecutive years. In the meantime, he had Nazarek. Nazarek couldn't quite get going in the car the way he had the year before, so he got out of it, and Johnny Parsons, who had won with it in 1950 and was now driving a Ferrari but not happy with that, came back in, and so the old team got together again, started last, and finished 10th, could actually have got much higher except for a minor problem on a pit stop where the two jacks, they had these old-fashioned type jacks where you would have long handles, two small wheels, push the thing underneath, pull the handle down, and then the car would go up onto the little caster wheels, front and back. Well, they both collapsed, and the car, with no wheels on it, ended up on the racetrack, and they had a heck of a time getting it back up, and it probably cost them at least fifth place, but they ended up 10th. Anyway, Frankie brought Johnny Thompson to the Speedway in 1953. He was a mechanic for Doc Saburin, so another great driver was introduced to the track through Frankie, and then 54, he was a mechanic for Fred Agabasian. George Bignotti came in as the engine man, so he worked with Frankie. They got six with Agabasian, and then fifth with Walt Faulkner and Bill Homer the next year. And then in about 1968-69, Frankie started getting involved with USAC as an official, and very shortly thereafter, the tech chairman. and that's a position that he held until that fateful night, April 23rd, 24th of 1978, when private plane coming back from Trenton, New Jersey, went down, and everybody on board was lost. So I'd like to talk a lot more about Frankie. He was a great guy, helped me a great deal, told me a lot of stuff, gave me, you know, intimate portraits of Floyd Roberts and Bill Cummings and all these people. But, Dave, we really thank you. What I want to do is to be able to get to Mark, and we got a couple of minutes left. So, Mark, we're kind of short-sheeting here a little bit, but go ahead with your question. We'll try and get you in.
I was wondering, back in the early years of the 500, I'm assuming they had some sort of safety teams in possession there, and I was curious as to how they communicated, whether there was an accident on the backstretch, and whether they had actually two-way radio communications at that point, and just exactly how what happened to, with the safety teams back then.
All right, well, two-way radios, no. Pretty much, in 1935, they put in warning lights. That was an Eddie Rickenbacker institution by putting in warning lights. Prior to that, it had been a flag system. I don't believe they were in radio communication. In fact, as I understand it, people placed around the track at different points would have the ability to wave a yellow flag in front of them. And then the person up the straightaway would see the yellow, and then they would wave the yellow, and then gradually it would come around to the chief starter. So if it was somebody in turn two, he wouldn't know about it for quite some time. So it took a little way to come around. When they put the yellow lights in, that kind of sped the process up considerably. But two-way radios, no, that didn't come until very much later. Anyway, we're sorry that we didn't give you much of an answer there, but we did want to try and get everybody in and have nobody hanging at the end of the show, and I think we were able to do that. We'd like to thank everybody for calling. We'll be back here tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Our thanks to Genius Number 1, Matt Hiblin down at the station, and Genius Number 2 is Scott Johnson that's out here. Those are the two producers, one at the station and one on site. Couldn't do it without either of them, and thank you both. And thank you, everybody, for calling in, and we'll be here tomorrow night with the Talk of Gasoline Alley on Network Indiana.